Hey everybody, thanks for downloading this episode of The Agile Wire. Before we jump into the show, if you haven't already, please consider leaving us a review or sharing with a friend. It means a lot to the chefs. Thanks.
Welcome to The Agile Wire, where professional scrum trainers Jeff Bubbles and Jeff Molesky discuss agile topics. Now, here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Jeff Molesky.
All right, and we are recording. All right, Mr. Bubbles, kick us off, man.
Sure. So this week on the Agile Wire, we got Ty Crockett. Ty is also a fellow PST, just like Jeff and myself. And we've got together at some different face-to-face events, and we thought, hey, it would be great to have Ty on the podcast. So Ty, why don't you just give our listeners just a little background about yourself?
All right, cool. I'm also a professional scrum trainer. I do consulting. I think if I teach this, I should probably do this. So I do a lot of consulting. I'm usually aimed at like an enterprise deal. My passion, though, ends up sitting around working with teams. I really dig human dynamics and stuff like that. My background before this was I did IT management for like 10 years, where I learned and found project management and stuff like that. That was pretty cool. But I think I got a bit burnt out during that time period, not so much with IT as much as like some of office politics and stuff like that that will revolve around it. Somebody introduced me to traditional project management. Didn't know about that. Was struggling with projects. Loved that. And then somebody told me I'd make a good Scrum Master, so I ended up getting into Scrum. Even way before that, I tried my hand at like looking to become a comic book artist. Even in college, I actually did a little bitty local comic here in Texas, and that paid for my lunch. That's what it did. Starving artist is a real thing.
Well, that explains a lot, because I remember you teaching that session on like how you do different drawings for like in the classes, yeah. Like the flips, yeah, that you do and stuff, yeah. And they're just amazing. And my kids always laugh at me because they're like, I can't believe people pay you to see these drawings. Like, they look like kindergartners. But yours are amazing. They look like a real artist, and it shows like you've got some skills, man.
I you know, there's a thing where like I love doing it, and that's my way to go back and touch it. When I was a kid, my best friend from high school, he kept doing it. Now he's a professional comic book artist, and he's one of the top ones. One of his comic books, Batman and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, they turned into a movie, which is kind of cool. So you guys can go check that out on whatever your movie thing is.
So quick question then to it. What's your favorite comic?
I gotta say, today, I think it's still, oh man, it's a hard toss up. So I've always been a Thor fan.
Okay.
And, I found Avengers later, and I always liked the offshoot Avengers, not the main group. Like, I was a West Coast Avengers collector, but nobody knows what the heck that is. Sure. And I used to love X-Men, but their main writer left after 16 years of being their core writer. And I remember him making a statement, what it took me like 16 years to build, they destroyed it in 6 months. And I have not been back since. And so today I would probably drop it around Thor somewhere. It's always had that feel that I like. I like the old English Thor more. They never, all that.
Sure, sure, sure. Awesome.
Which puts me on the Marvel side, in case there's DC fans who are listening. I'm very strongly on the Marvel side. I do collect DC comics, but I'm mostly a Marvel guy. And I'm Star Wars instead of Star Trek, though I know both.
It's really good that you put your lines in the sand right up front.
Right? That's right. Well,
yep.
You got to stand for something.
Awesome. So we were talking before about a number of different topics. And I thought, if you don't mind, that one of the first ones that I thought would be really interesting to dive down into is that diversity topic. And, you know, especially with what's going on in the conversation today, you know, kick us off, man. So what are your thoughts on diversity here for us?
I think I want to like center it in on our space in the agile, and I would even say it specifically down in like the Scrum space. I think when it comes to this, we struggle, and I say we struggle because of like when it comes to thought leadership and the voices that we listen to, I think it turns to be fairly homogenous. Right? And I think it stems from where we started at. Like, if we go and look at, you know, Snowbird in 2001, that's a pretty homogenous group. It was even hard to put a tester in. So, so we struggle with this, and it's not just that piece and that niche of the industry. It's kind of systematic throughout. Even our organization struggles with this. I mean, when we look at our leaders, they tend to, and I'm sorry, talking about my personal organization. I work for a company called Improving. When we look at our leaders, we struggle to make sure that, one, we have excellence in leadership and quality, excellence in treating our people as humans, and try to maintain our diversity. And of course, there's a ton of different things that we talk about when it comes to diversity, but we can't ignore like that half of the population is not represented in half of what our leadership looks like. And so I start to struggle with stuff like this. And then, man, if I go to any conference ever, finding another person who looks like me is pretty tough. I did a lot of work in Minnesota, and I got to go to their technology conference. And one of my coworkers kind of gave me a heads up, like, okay, Minnesota looks a certain way. But I'm like, oh, no. Because I've been driving around, right? But what I have seen was, what does it look like for people who are working in an airport, working at the hotel, driving Lyft or Uber or the cab or whatever I was in? And so there was like this stratified thing going on. And when I went to this technology conference, there was me and there was another lady who was there with her daughter. Her daughter was there with her. And it was an older lady who was there, and she was the only other Black person inside this technology conference. I mean, I was like looking and walking around and I learned all this cool stuff and it was so awesome. But I was like, this was my, oh my goodness, wow, I was shocking. I come from Dallas, so I'm in a pretty high tech area and it's a lot of diversity here. But I still struggle with finding people that are like me, and like the opportunity to mentor is absolutely there. But peers and finding people in that space, even amongst us as PSTs, there are not a tremendous amount of for me, Black people, but there's not a tremendous amount of diversity amongst us. And we struggle with this. And there's definitely efforts to go on and try to make it different, but it's still a struggle point. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think? Like, how do you solve this systematic problem? Like, what are some of the first steps?
I like things that I see where people get into it. When I go talk at conferences, I used to go around with a few friends and do women in tech talk. Because there's a lot of people who, you know, I personally am being mentored by or are mentoring me, and they're female. And I would always bring my kids. And this is even when my son was young, but people wouldn't. And the talks are not too highbrow for them to get, especially there's ones that are definitely not highbrow, right? And I think it starts with, we have to bring in people earlier. That's a solution for later. For right now, it's more programs to attract people right now, because especially in technology, sometimes the step in is less than a year. We do boot camps and stuff like that inside my own organization, and we can get somebody up to speed in a really short time to get started. I think this industry suffers from gatekeepers. Like, oh no, you're not one of us. You can't come in. And pretty soon people stop trying. And this is what's crazy. So here's the other thing that I noticed. I went and worked with a company, and I'm going back to Minnesota, and it was 51% women in leadership. And when I was talking to them, I was like, oh, you guys don't know. This is an amazing thing. And the place that you have feels different because of that acceptance of it doesn't matter in this space. And so I think places like that being spotlighted, teaching other places how you might do this, I think there's something that we, things that we can be doing now to affect the now and investment in the future. You know, so I think that's the spaces. I love little things in, you know, in schools and colleges, just going back and reinvesting. And I think we have to invest in places that are impoverished, which is a really hard thing to do. I would think that a lot of people would be like, oh, I'm not going to go there.
So one of the things that you were talking about earlier is those barriers to entry. And I think you're spot on with it's not all that time intensive to get started in IT. I mean, I think back to, I took a 30 day, my school was an immersive school. So it was 8 hours of class every day that we were doing, but you learned the code in 30 days. That was your first introductory class was, you know, we actually made an RPG in console in C. So that was the very first class that we had. But from a time perspective, I spot on, but the upfront cost, like you need to pay for a computer in some way, shape or form to run whatever your, you know, Visual Studio or what, I forget what the IDE is for Java, Eclipse. There we go. But you know, that's at minimally a $300-$500 somewhere inside of their, contribution that you're going to be making to that. And that's for somebody making minimum wage, that's a pretty big financial step for them. And then, especially if we're talking about, well, how do we get kids involved in this or so I'm not, I am totally on board with what you're saying. I think we do need to introduce and open these doors of opportunities. But I think that we should be working at making it easier, not just from a time perspective, but that dollar amount of what do you have to put down for in order to even get started on this? Because I think that is kind of a big gateway to keeping new people out of that industry. The other thing is, and I'm going to completely butcher this, but I was literally just last night watching the Brett Weinstein interview on Joe Rogan, and he was talking about these inequalities that are out there and how it's been framed as racism. And I'm not going to diminish from that conversation, say one way or the other, but the way he was talking about it was it's these patterns that are left over. And so we have patterns in underserved communities that just continue to propagate being underserved. And that's more of a pattern. Now that pattern started in racism and the inequalities that were out there, but we haven't fixed those systems of reproducing patterns. And so we've got patterns of class, you know, class of higher educated, more wealthy individuals. And that pattern just propagates. And because wealth has a tendency to pool, until we fix those patterns, that's really the problem. We just feel like it's, you know, maybe it's racism or inequality in that regard. So again, I'm going to butcher that, but I think that's just as applicable to the underserved. Well, they are in a pattern of an environment that's going to continue to replicate. And we should be thinking about how do we break out of those patterns, those vicious cycles, make virtuous ones to get them out. And I think part of that is understanding diversity, and that opens our eyes to that, but then also understanding the barriers to breaking down those patterns of reproduction.
Very much agree. Yeah, I'm from a farm in Kansas, like a small vegetable farm, not the big combine type. My granddad would sit on the side of the road and drink a fifth of Jack and sell vegetables out of the bed of a truck, right? We were poor, like really, really poor. And I was able to take hold of opportunities, but that was because my grandparents were like, you must go do this. They couldn't teach me this stuff. They made sure that they sent me in the right places and put me in the right places. And so I had that, but I don't know that everybody has that. And I agree with you. It is that pattern space. My kids have a totally different experience. I live in a suburb and things are nice, and we're really close to one of the COVID hotspots here in the States, but it doesn't seem like it because we're out here in the suburbs and we're not seeing all the same people. I'm like, oh, that's less than 40 miles away. And so this is, it is a very different thing than what I see in the suburbs here than what I saw when I was growing up. And that the pattern. So this is the part that to me becomes the systemic piece. My family that I grew up with was not very good with managing finances. So I was taught, not purposely, but taught those same behaviors. So when I got started, well, that's how I manage finances. I had to those mentors and people that helped me break out of it. But that thing that helps people to break out is not a part of this bigger system that I see exists. The momentum of what happens when you're not inside a program or inside a structured environment that is meant to go do that for you, which is the rest of your life, is super strong and really hard to overcome. And so I feel I'm lucky because I was able to break out of what I see as a cycle of my family, my big, larger family going through. I don't think that that's easy or frequent. I think that is a really hard space. I totally agree with this, as the patterns have to change.
And part of it, I think, I was thinking about the financing that you were bringing up earlier. And so many people, that's something we just don't talk about. And so back to stuff we talk about every single day in a classroom, transparency solves a lot of problems. And so if you can make certain things transparent and you do talk about it, maybe that's where some of that education can come in. Because a lot of times you wouldn't even know that. Like, if we were both developers on a team together, tie back early in your career, I wouldn't know that you were really bad with your finances. And I probably wouldn't know how to like even give you coaching, or I wouldn't talk about that. That'd be kind of a taboo thing to talk about, yeah, you know? Right.
Yeah. That was one thing that was hard for me to break too, because for me to get out of the cycle, I had to be able to talk about it, because if I wanted to learn from people who obviously were doing it right, that means I had to ask questions about finances.
Yeah.
And like, oh, how are you doing this? Which is like a, but yeah, that stuff, I think is all in that space. And then people want to give. Now, this is a thing that I think is one of the today kind of things. Now, people are, a lot of my friends have come and asked me like, okay, I don't know what to say without like saying something crazy, and then I've done more harm than I have good. And so I want to be helpful, but I don't know what to do. This will be something that will be in that space. Like, do something helpful to help break the system, help break the cycle that's happening. And that thing about mentioning giving to something that provides those hard to get resources for an effective program. And that's another thing, man, there are so many things that are like crap solutions or scams even in the space of trying to help people. Mm-hmm. That's a really hard one for me to, the amount of due diligence I feel like I need to do to validate whether this is real or not, and whether you're going to do the thing that you said, that becomes pretty tough. And so I wish I had, I don't have that answer. I don't think, but I believe that it exists in the spaces that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually just had a student come in through, it was some, he was in government, but he worked for like basically homeless individuals, right? And we were, I'm not letting the cat out of the bag with anything, but we were doing the burger kitchen scenario. The students always play around and have some fun with it. And like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe this is a homeless person and they need some food. They don't have it. And he said, look, one of the worst things you can do for a homeless person is to just give them money. Okay. That there are systems set up to help those individuals. And when you're giving it to them, that it's bypassing those systems. It's making, I forget how he articulated it. It was really well done. A system of dependency on that. And you're actually robbing it when you give it directly to that person from all the discounts that the homeless shelter gets and all that jazz. So I'm just kind of tying this back to what you were just saying, like good intent, bad ideas, right? Like the intent is to help this person. And so I'm just going to give them some money. But that's not the right solution. That's not actually fixing the underlying problems that's inside of there. And I just listened to another podcast about this, but like, it's almost you're doing something just to relieve your guilt. Hey, I feel better now because I did something, but it didn't actually help the situation. I've just relieved the guilt on my side, anyway, I thought it was kind of applicable to what we were just talking through.
I think I go and do the things that are just crazy and almost in the impossible. My family, I should say my two sons and I used to go on the weekends and do this shower ministry thing for the homeless, because something I never thought of until I got involved with this thing is, like, there's not really a space where you can go take showers. And so this group in downtown Dallas set up this these like portable shower places, and there's like maybe 10 or 20 showers, women on one side, men on one side. And it, people would just come in and they take showers and they could get some new clothes, maybe a new belt. They kept a registry and they checked. You could get one of these things every X times that you came or something like that. But my kids and I would go, and it was dangerous. So let me put it like this way. There was risk, because a good portion of those people that were homeless, there is also an association with some type of mental illness.
Yes.
And a lot of that, a lot of times, what we see is the violent aspect of what that mental illness could turn into. Mm-hmm. So taking my kids to it, a lot of people are like, why would you do this? And I'm like, oh, if this is what I want my kids to be, when am I going to start asking them to be these people? And so I did it. And, you know, I made sure it wasn't like deadly, but it was something that even to this day, there's stuff that they learned when they were doing it. But just one about people, there was times when my youngest son could go and comb somebody just because it was a child there. There were times when they would go and have to clean out some pretty dirty showers, but they remember like this bleach water mix that would kill and sanitize things. And they still use these concepts when they're like having to do stuff around the house. And I'm like, that was really effective. But I think, and we'd have to have these really hard conversations and talks, because while my language is filtered, everybody's wasn't. And while my behavior was filtered, everybody's wasn't. And there was drug use and there was all this stuff, right? And we had to have some pretty tough conversations. But we did. So this makes me think of, like, and even in our situation today, I struggle with people like, I don't know what to do about this. And I often ask, have you talked to your family about it? And maybe there's the spouse or significant other conversation, but talking to your kids about something so difficult as what we're talking about today is a really hard one. We end up having one or two conversations around the house today, but it's brought some really adult topics to my, I have a 14-year-old. About to be 15, so I got to put that in there. it's about some really adult topics. The thing of, like, when I have a 25-year-old too. When he leaves the house, I'm scared. Today more than ever. And is it because this stuff is more public? I think that might be why I'm more nervous. I've always been nervous, like, he's going to go out, he's going to say something crazy, he's going to get in trouble, he's not going to respond the right way, that kind of stuff, right? But today, I think I'm more fearful of when he leaves the house. Mm-hmm. No, I just don't want him to. And now we get into, like, discussions about it. Like, it feels like you're trying to, but that's the truth. And I have to discuss that with him. And he has a son. And so when he, you know, I'm having the thing of, like, you're going to probably feel this at some point in time. It'd be really nice if by that time he didn't, but that's the thing that's for me. And it was a thing that was a problem for my parents. And, like, this is the thing that we have to stop. Like, I don't want to feel that, you know, and no one should.
Yeah, but it sounds like the things you're talking about that you're doing is, there's a saying out there that you made me think of. It's like, you can either prepare your child for the path or have your child or
child for the road, not the road for the child.
For the path. Yep, yeah. Exactly. And so it's like, well, you make them more anti-fragile, you know, more resilient to handle, you know, whatever's going to be thrown at them by exposing them to the different things like that and having those hard conversations when you're around as a parent to guide and mentor them. When they're 18, 20, 30 years old, maybe they don't go ask their parents those kind of hard questions. And then they just go wherever, you know, the road takes them, you know? So I think that's a great thing. I think that's a good thing that any, you know, parent can do. Anybody can mentor anybody. As we were kind of talking about this conversation, I was thinking more about like our space, like how can we make a difference? And there's this organization in Milwaukee, and I don't know if they have anything like this in Dallas, but it's called The Commons. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they take people from high school through college, even people like in their careers, and they're looking to get diverse groups of people together. And they teach them how to do like design sprints and like basically come up with like business plans. And then they contract that out to different, usually larger companies. Like we've got, you know, like NM, Northwestern Mutual. We've got Harley Davidson. We've got a couple other, you know, big companies here in Milwaukee. And they hire these people to come in and they help them design new products. And then they help kind of like go through the ideation phase into like, let's build some prototypes. And then sometimes they stick on and you know, help build things out. Sometimes it's just like, get it started. And then they have different groups doing different things. But it's exposure to the business world for this group of people that wouldn't have probably ever had that. And then like they're sitting in a room with a bunch of executives that, you know, probably don't look like them. Yeah. But they're getting confidence that, hey, we can pitch a business plan to, you know, a Fortune 5 or Fortune 10 company or whatever NNM is. And like, and maybe they'll take it like, hey, we can do this. So I think it's a pretty cool program that's out there. And
awesome.
Yeah. So I think like those types of things are pretty amazing.
Yeah. That's awesome. That one to me is more along the lines of like what I would want to see happening. Ours are more in the traditional space. The funny part is the ones where our intentions lie have actually spawned things that hit in the space of increased diversity. So we do one for that's a boot camp, and the boot camp is like, hey, do you know somebody who would just be awesome at this, but they don't have the training or skills? We can do that. We have those, so we bring them in, and we do like a 14-week. I think it's 14 weeks boot camp, and we've just had some amazing people come out of it. And I don't know that those opportunities would have arisen had we not done something like that. So that's a really cool one.
Is this just for developers, or is this for like everything within our tech space? I mean, are you doing it for product owners, scrum masters?
We've done it a bunch of different ways. It is hard because we try to make it where we can go and market the position afterwards. We want to actually have them for the company. That's two purposes, right? Mm-hmm. We often will partner with companies to do it. So this has been our new way of doing it. First, we did it on our own. It was a way of generating people. Like one of the person who named the company Improving was a product of a boot camp. So it was really a passion for him. And he's from way back. And so he ran our first one, and we got some more amazing people who are still with our company from that. And so we just kept running. But eventually our partners and clients would say, hey, we want to do something like that too. And so we started putting those in. Another one that we do that has gotten us into a more diverse space is something called Agile for Patriots. It's not something we created, but it's a group that we partner with. One of the people who created it, Ravi Verma, is one of the people who created this. And then there's some people locally who work with him to do it. We just try to help as much as we can. And this one's amazing to me because it's not just the veterans who we're helping in that space, but it's also their families. Like the spouse of a vet would be eligible to go through this program. And we do all the teaching and stuff, and it does produce scrum masters and product owners and that stuff. But the crazy part is these people who they would have not had this chance at all. And I am seeing a high percentage of minority. We do them in classes. One of the classes was exclusively women. That's just who showed up and who decided to do the thing. And so now it's spreading to other areas. I think there's one coming up in Houston, one in Minnesota, and in the Twin Cities. And so this has been one that I've done too. Its purpose was about like helping vets, but its outcome is there is a extremely diverse group that's being helped by doing this because, well, vets look like that. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
The company that Jeff and I used to work for a while ago had a very similar program to what you were talking through. They had they called it an apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. And so they would bring in typically college graduates at that level, or just anybody who didn't have that type of experience. And I want to say the program was probably 3 to 6 months, somewhere in that time frame. Now, to what you were saying is obviously we would try and keep the cream of the crop from that. But it was more about just bringing more skill sets to people, giving them on the job experience. They'd literally be building products for our customers because it was another consulting group, just like improving, and then giving them that first step to actually take on their career. And that was really rewarding to get to work with. I think there's, in bringing this back to what you were talking about earlier, Jeff, you know, preparing the child for the road, like that's just good parenting, right? Like if you enjoy building people up, you're likely going to be a good people person and a good servant leader or hopefully a good scrum master, but that's one of those traits to be in there. But I think just enjoying seeing people grow over time, seeing people overcome, add more skills to their toolbox, et cetera, and then that kind of taking the next step of going on. And the last thought I had in my head was even like Tuckman's model of team formation, right? The adjournment step, right? The opportunity for now what used to be the junior members of the team to potentially step up and now lead other teams of their own and going on. Like that's just a natural step in that progression. And that was something we kind of kept in mind for all of the courses that we were doing or the apprenticeship programs that we had. So it's cool that you're also doing that, your organization kind of growing people and helping them get that first step in the career.
Yeah. If it comes to like our space, this is in getting the newer people started, there's a few people that do stuff that one of the ones who got me started being interested in this, one of my coworkers, Allison Pollard, she is a part of a engineering fraternity. And so she goes back and she does little things with their groups and teaches them skills that she uses in her job every day. But now instead of like waiting till when she got them, she's making sure that they have these things right at the start, like it's starting their work career or whatever. And that like got me to like, man, yep, universities are still really far behind when it comes to modern methods of work, modern strategies on how teams should work. Just everything about this space seems to be a little bit far behind. One of PST's Maggie Schoonover and Greg Crown, they own this company, SmashDev in Kansas. They teach at Wichita State University. He's the undergrad and master's program for what agility looks like. One, I know that they're teaching them good stuff because they're teaching what we would teach, right? But it's so cool to see that happen this early. And those type of innovations, I think, are something that's a cool near way of developing things. Jeff, you were saying you were involved in something like this too, right?
Yeah, I've been working, especially now that we're all remote and everybody has to transition. There's a group that called FCA that Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and I've got a friend of mine from high school who leads a group, and we were chatting, and he's like, this is a few months ago, and he's like, we're doing these Zoom calls. They're not quite the same. I'll, kind of went into it. And so I said, hey, what if I help you and teach you some liberating structures? And hey, I'm using these things for my classes. Maybe they would work for you. And so we just started doing them. And then he's like, oh, these are awesome. Like, and you'd be a surprise. Like he's got 13 to, 18 year old students that are in these, they do them a couple times a week, two, three times a week, these sessions that are like an hour, hour and a half. And they are using different liberating structures, and they pick them up like that. Like, it's just amazing. And now, like, that they've been doing this for a while, they're picking it up more and more. And it's like, this is going to be a superpower for them. At least that's what I feel like. Like, I think facilitation can be a superpower. So you don't even have to know anything about the subject, but it gets you in the room often. And maybe that's a good thing. Like, for anybody that's trying to grow in their career and get into a space, like, if you can be a really good facilitator, man, this will put you in the room to learn more, and you get to hear just the context behind it. And so one of the things we're doing in August now, we actually have some meetings coming up next week, is we're starting to plan. There's a leadership camp for high school students and across 18 different locations, but they would normally all come together, but they're going to spread it off, all these smaller locations, but they still want to do some group things. And so we're going to use we're planning different liberating structures, different things that we can use for video, and how can we collaborate across all these groups across 18 different locations over a 2-day leadership camp. So I think it's pretty amazing. And I think that this stuff can cascade really fast, because once people start learning it and they learn the patterns and learn the meta level of it, they'll just apply it in everything that they're doing. Or at least that's what I'm seeing and hearing stories about as I'm working with these different students. So I guess anyone out there that already knows liberating structure, already knows good facilitation techniques, like, use it outside of your professional life and other places would be my nudge, because like it can be a really powerful thing.
That's true. One of the things that I am super proud of as being a member of a participant with scrum.org is their program for helping education groups and education organizations start to learn and use their content early. That's been this gets into the financial space that we were talking about earlier. It's really expensive to buy a computer. It's really expensive to take one of these courses. And that's always been the case. Yeah. Right? It's higher learning, especially specialized instance learning, like our classes are super expensive for people. And Scrum.org has given us a path where we're dedicating our time and they're making the other things make sense so that we can help people who normally wouldn't get this opportunity. And so I love those programs. I want to see more of them. I wish there was like a place where you could see it all collected on what is available out there, because yeah. They're not sending people in that direction. People are always asking me, this is one of those questions I get in class. How do you get started?
Yeah.
And especially like Scrum Master. How do you get started in Scrum Master? I think it's so much easier to get started than Product Owner. In Scrum Master, it's almost like I do the Steve Martin thing. Like, how do you make $1 million? Like, first, get $1 million. Because... the first thing you do when you want to become a Scrum Master is, well, okay, so how much Scrum Master experience do you have? Like, no, I want to be a Scrum Master. Like, great. First, you get a job being a Scrum Master and you do it, and then somebody will hire you to be a Scrum Master, because Nobody's going to hire you to do the thing that you don't know how to do, and it's not a starter position, and this starts to be a really weird space. Now, if you're in the place, yeah, just start doing it. But if you're not in the place already, that's a really hard thing. And I don't know what the solution for that is either.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I just struggled with this. I had a meetup earlier this week, and we combined across a bunch of different meetups. We had like 5 meetups joined together, and it got to be pretty big. And you know, as people were kind of falling off, I started having different conversations with some different people. And there's this one lady, she's been a coach and running her own company for a while, and she wants to transition into being an agile coach or a scrum master, but she doesn't have any scrum experience. And she's like, do I just go do a 2-day course? And I'm just like, man, you got a lot of facilitation skills. You've got a lot of change management skills. You got a lot of interpersonal, like people skills and conflict management skills. You got a lot of stuff going for you, but you got to get the scrum, and you've never been in technology. So like, you got to get, if you want to go into work with an IT team, like you got to have some context too. I said, I think you just got to get started being a Scrum Master. And she's like, but how do you get started without like having the experience? And I'm like, I know. Like, I guess my nudge was, is like, there are companies out there that will hire you if you've got a, you know, PSM. They'll hire you because you got a PSM. You got this other stuff. They can see the potential. They'll hire you. There's some that won't, you know, a small 50-person company. It's got 3 Scrum teams. They're like, if I make a bad hire at this position, my company can go bankrupt. Yeah. I really got to make sure that this person has experience, can really, you know, has done this before. But maybe a larger company can be like, yeah, I can see there's a lot of potential there. But my fear is, again, like we were talking before we started recording, there's different types of Scrum out there. There's professional Scrum that we teach. There's, you know, maybe the safe version of Scrum. And then there's the company version of Scrum or whatever flavor, you know, however you've changed it, you know. So I don't want her to go in and say, this is what I learned. And now she's kind of maybe, I don't know, put down a path that pigeonholes her to only stay at a certain company, only do things a certain way. And so, I don't know, I struggled with that as I was talking through with her. I'm like, these are things to watch out for. Maybe we just need to have frequent conversations and I can help, you know, guide you through this as you kind of do that and help you make good decisions. And cause you probably need a mentor when you get started in one of these types of positions. Cause it's tough. Like, I 100% agree with you. Like, until you get the experience, like, how do you know what you don't know? You don't. So,
if you don't need a mentor, I don't know how you do it, because that's the way I came up. And that's the way most people I know came up, that somebody was helping them learn, right?
Yeah, I was going to jump in real quick. You were talking about those different flavors of Scrum there. And all I would say it's almost as frequent as it is infrequent that you're running into somebody who's a scrum master that is really not a scrum master, right? They're really just a project manager with the title of a scrum master, or, you know, insert whatever scenario here. So it made me think of basic training in the Army. And I, you know, the drill sergeant would always say, like, the hardest soldier to teach how to shoot is one that's shot before coming in the door, because now you got to untrain all the bad steps or processes that they've learned over time, bad habits. That's what I was looking for. Yeah. You got to unlearn all of those bad habits and teach them the proper way to shoot a weapon. And so having that person who hasn't even learned the good or the bad habits right now, they're just coming in the door fresh. Like Jeff was saying, you got this person who's great at coaching, great at interpersonal skills, great at understanding systems maybe, but they don't know Scrum yet. Awesome. Let's get them in there. We can teach you Scrum in 2 hours. That's Scrum is not, and I tell this to all the students, Scrum is not the issue. Okay. We can teach you Scrum in 2 hours, but that's not the hard part of anything you're going to run into. So, and then what you were saying, Ty, with setting up that mentorship. Yeah, absolutely. Like I love, one of the more rewarding aspects of being a trainer is having that student who reaches out to you 3 months, 6 months, years later, and is saying, "Hey, I ran into this issue. What, you know, how? Give me some coaching or some advice about how to take that." Like, I love those opportunities to kind of go back and help people along on their journey. Like the kind of what we were just talking about, but that 2 day course, that this is the joke that I think everybody knows, like a 2 day course of Scrum Mastery does not make you the master of Scrum, right? All that does is open the door for you and start your journey. And this is a journey, right? Mastery is 10,000 hours or 10 years of doing this job. You're not getting that in 2 days, and no certification is going to, you know, take the place of it. Yeah. So, but having the opportunity as a trainer to connect with a student who's somewhere along that pathway, somewhere on that journey, and continuing to help mentor them or provide some guidance to them, that's the at least to me, that's a super rewarding point. Along with all those light bulb moments that students have in the classroom, it's like, oh, now this makes sense. Now I understand why this goes with this, and these rules start to make sense to me. Like that's those are the powerful moments that are fun, but that's all in a classroom. It's not until that the rubber hits the road, you're out in the real world, you're trying to get that change going. And it's like, you just, sometimes you hit that wall and you just need to have that conversation with somebody else to provide that mentorship in the door. But, you know, back to where I started this tirade, like just because you don't have that experience, don't write it off, right? Sometimes that could be the best thing in the world for an organization, that you're coming in fresh and you don't have potentially these bad habits that might've been picked up somewhere else. So,
yeah, my sister works in tax accounting, and she would hear me talking about stuff like this, and she started suggesting it. She used to be a teacher, and she started with her teaching. I forget what they call it, like cadre or something like that. They call it like
the cadre.
See who worked together, and she started there with them doing Scrum stuff. Then she went into tax accounting later in her career, and she found that there was things where she could use it. And I guess it became sort of popular, and they brought in a group to show them how to do this. she knew a little bit, because now she's been doing it, right? She started where she was, and that was it. And then what she's been doing, and she's like, actually, it works better this. And let me tell you why. And oh man, when the people who are coming in doing the mechanical thing didn't have a why behind it,
yep,
there's not much to say. Watching people who are, even when they're new to it, but they understand why, they are powerful. So dig it.
Yeah, I think that's, I think a lot about like training, I don't know, I played a lot of sports back in high school, and you would go to a camp, and you might go to a 2 day camp, or you might go to a, you know, 3 or 4 day camp in the summer. And does that really make you that much better for the sport that you're in? Not really, but you might learn some techniques, or you might learn something that's like, I now understand why my coach all season has been harping on this one thing. Yeah. And just maybe hearing it a different way and understanding the whys helps you then refine that thing to then like be better at it when you actually need to use it. And I think of training very similar to that. Like we try to have all these light bulb moments and explain the whys so that when those situations come up, you can take that why and solve your own problem. And so I guess back to our point before, like the 2 days of training doesn't make you an expert, but hopefully knowing the whys gives you the tools that you can solve your own problems in the future.
Yeah. I always consider there's the slow burn or the slow buildup of doing it over and over again, experiment. Then you get this big spike of stuff. Like you go to a class, you're like, okay, they said like 10 things. I got 3 of them and I'm going to work these 3 things. I'm going to be awesome because I work these 3 things. And I found myself doing this ever since I got started. I would always take a class once per year. And my hope is that I get to take it from a different trainer because everybody has a different angle that they end up delivering this at. And that's paid off really well for me. Even like today, I take a class and I took a Kanban class last week. And I've been to Kanban forever, but I took a class and watching a different angle, it grounds me. I'm like, you know what? I've been like compensating for a deficiency in some other area and have strayed off of this path and been doing this kind of poorly. And now I've taken that bad habit with me everywhere. Like that's the way you're supposed to do it as opposed to I had to do something one time. And now I start getting, you know, and it grounds me. It brings me back to like, okay, here's what beautiful would look like. How do I go back and do beautiful at the other places that I'm going to go touch? And I love classes for that recentering. I love them for the foundational grounding. But man, I love being there for the duration because I get that high of teaching and somebody gets an aha moment, but I like the endless ahas of working with people and doing it in that space too. So I need all those things, which sometimes frustrates people around me as I'm a consultant. They're like, are you a consultant or are you a trainer? I'm like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
I need all these things. That's a weird model.
Yeah. But I think that gives you a lot of experience doing it and helps you to figure out like what resonates in a 2-day class as you go through. And now you see the after effects as you help somebody implement it. Right. Because I do a very similar thing. Like I do a lot of, Jeff does a lot more training volume wise than I do. But I do a lot of training with a client, spending a lot of time helping them implement it. 1 or 2 clients at a time I'm working with. And I think I find that very rewarding too, because like for me is when I hear people saying my words, or at least it sounds like my words coming out of their mouth. Yeah. Then I'm like, oh, I feel like I would have said something just like that. That's really rewarding for me, because especially knowing like where they were maybe, you know, months before this, and it's like they would have never said something like that. Yeah. And that's when I know like, okay, they're getting there. Maybe that's now the time for me to leave. Like they can solve their own problems if they're doing this now. They understand the whys. They can articulate it very well, and they can move change forward. So yeah, I think that's great that you like you want a little bit of everything. I think I want a little bit of everything too. That's what I'm finding.
Yeah, that's the best. So either like you and whoever your client is, like either we're both brilliant or
yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All right. So, I'm just going back to our topics here because we had some good ones. Before I pick the question that I want to ask, Ty, do you remember anything else specifically that you wanted to talk about?
There was one that just came up from what you were talking about in the real world. That's a thing that I get in class.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but in the real world.
Is it nails on a chalkboard whenever you hear that?
I'm like, for me, I'm like, oh, you don't understand. Like elves, dwarves, lightsabers, like I want to work in the fantasy world. I can't. Like the only place I get to go is the real world. And that's always like my thing that I end up dealing with that at. But in the real world, and I understand there's some things that are, and I wouldn't call them theoretical. It's hypothetical because we're just like, I had this wild idea. It should work. And I often ask people, have you ever tried that? Or have you ever tried something that would lead you to believe that this works? Or is it just, I'm going to hold you accountable to this thing that I thought wasn't, a wise thing in the moment. So in the real world is something that I find is a funny thing in my courses, in my classes, and when I'm working. Do you guys get that same one in the real world?
Oh, yeah.
How do you deal?
I have to, like, de-escalate myself whenever I hear that because, well, I know they don't mean it to be, but it's almost insulting when it's like, oh, you're talking theory. I'm like, no, dude, I this is literally how I develop products for 10 years. Right? I have this experience, and I tell generally in the PSPO course, but I'm like, look, I'm a fan of Scrum because I have 8 years as a product owner. I never failed to deliver a product to market. Every one of the products made it to market. Now, some were more successful than other ones. Absolutely. But all I did was follow this, right? Mm-hmm. That's why I'm a fan of this. So, but like I said, like I'm even getting that was not fantasy land. There weren't rainbows and unicorns jumping around that whole time. Like, that was reality. Now, I get that your situation might make this difficult, but this goes right back to my earlier comment, right? Scrum is easy. It's the changes that you're going to have to make to how you are doing things today versus how Scrum wants you to do that. That's the hard part. That's where you're going to struggle with all of this stuff, right? And I think that's where the disconnect is with students. It's like, how are we ever going to change this area to start doing things like that? It's like, I don't know how you're going to do that. That's you needing to learn how to do that, because Scrum doesn't care, right? Yeah. Scrum framework is going to assign you those 11 elements, the five events, the three roles, three artifacts, some rules that bind them together. And you got to figure out the rest of how to apply it in your context. That's what makes it reality.
Yeah.
I always call it out when I hear it, but I've noticed, I guess, that people will say, oh, in the real world, sometimes when I'm trying to explain the why behind, like, here's why we need to define our products in a certain way. If we, you know, if we define them inside out, this is what it leads to. If we define them outside in, here's what it leads to. But they're like, yeah, but in the real world, how do you do this with this large of a company and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, well, I'm trying to explain the why, and like, here's the cascading effects. You have a system that you're a part of. You need to change the system, and there's other underlying things that are a part of that are pushing you in a certain direction. Why is that, and how do we change those things so that you can be more successful? Because that's the outcome you're really looking for. And so then I'll give them real examples, like, here's how I've done this. And then they're like, okay, that's maybe what they're looking for. So sometimes I think they're really just like, give me a real example, because this sounds very like, you know, textbook or very like academic of what you're saying. And it's like, here's how you can apply it. And then once they hear a few examples, they're like, okay, I'm getting it, you know, or maybe that doesn't work exactly in my context, but I see where maybe I could change something. But if you start with examples without the why, I feel like then people are like, this is the practice, and the practice will solve the problem. And the practice isn't the way you solve the problem. It's the why. And then there's many practices that you need to tweak depending on your context, right? So like, I don't know. Those are all the nuances, I think, of that conversation. So I think it happens for a reason, and yeah. I'm okay with it happening when it happens, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying there, Jeff. I think one of the nice things, and I can't speak for all the PSTs that are out there, but I believe this might be actually one of the barriers to entry, is like, you have to have lived through this stuff. Like, you can't just come in and be purely academic with to be a PST. You have to have been on Scrum teams, down in the trenches, you know, the boots hitting the ground with all of this stuff. And so we have the stories of, no, this is not academic. This is where we've applied it. Here's the battle wounds that we have from trying to do it this way versus that way. And we can talk to what reality is. And then, you know, the good example that I always talk about is the self-organization activity, right? Like, it wasn't 200 people, but here's how I've done it with Jeff, with 60 people, right? And we were done in what, like an hour and a half or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is, I get that it may be uncomfortable, and I have a term in my head, and I'm struggling with how to make it more kind. But in essence, it's, don't confuse your inability to do something with it not being capable of being done. Okay. Just because you've never done it before, just because you've never experienced it, doesn't mean that it's not possible. Doesn't mean that it's not reality. And I think that's where a lot of people have that disconnect, because they just haven't seen it done that way. What is it? There's a bias. I think it's what you see is all there is. The black swan, right? I've never seen one. Why would I expect one to occur naturally in nature, right? Because they've never seen it be performed this way. They've never experienced it. They don't think it can be done that way. And so, you know, I don't want to beat up on them too badly, but I think maybe, I think one of our superpowers as trainers is to say, we've actually lived through just about all of these scenarios before. We can make them applicable to the students and draw them back into, if they haven't made that bridge in their minds yet, of what we're teaching versus how their organizations are, you know, this is what reality is. So,
and be empathetic to the difficulty of them trying to understand how they're going to go through this change, right? So yes, mm-hmm. it's possible. I'm with you. I remember when I was here. they're like, oh, there is no other way but this way, and this is what it looked like forevermore. Carry this.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that empathy is that's the word I was trying to articulate all of that with is you just have to help build the empathy for them, and so vice versa, right? Then they start to understand your situation as well. So I think that was well put.
Yeah, empathy, but I'm also going to be, you need to be persistent and continue to push the change. Like, you can't just be a victim here, right? Like, you have to take some accountability for the system you're in or changing it, right? And maybe that gets back to our earlier conversation about diversity. Like, we all have an accountability in that, right? And what are you doing to change it? And so I think that applies to so many things in our lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, this has been a great conversation, Ty. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for joining us this morning. We made Jeff get out of bed early, and he loves that.
No, dude.
but at this time, is there anything you want to plug? Anything you want to promote? Anything you're doing, like talks? I don't know, blog articles. Anything else that you want to like put out there to the listeners?
All the ones that I've been doing recently. I don't think any of the remainder of them are public. I did my last public one yesterday. Which I think I can say we find on our YouTube channel, we're improving. So that's the YouTube channel, just improving. You'll see the little splash on the image. I've been doing one on, virtual Scrum Mastery. I think everybody's like looking for more virtual. How do I do this in the virtual world content? But we've been doing an entire virtual series. So like improving.com/virtual-events, and we've just been doing like webinars, and they're still continuing on. We found that, man, in this time period, we need to reach out a lot more than we were before, because the opportunities are just not existing in the physical, especially with our user groups not being able to meet as in person as we were before. So that's I think that'd be the big thing that I plug, and wash your hands.
Wear a mask.
Thank you for listening to the Agile Wire. We are consistently inspecting and adapting ourselves. We would appreciate feedback at feedback@theagilewire.com or on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play Store. See you next time.